The final speaker is Professor Philip Hamill of the University of Strathclyde. And the paper today, I think, seems to weave together, if that's not too late, but a comparison. Very long-standing and very productive research interests, as can be seen in previous publications, including literary culture and female authorship in Canada from 2003. Women, Celebrity and Literary Culture Between the Wars from 2007, and my favourite, 2010 Sophistication for Literary and Cultural History. They also co-founded the AHRC Middlebrow Network, which led on to the AHRC project Magazines, Travel and Middlebrow Culture in Canada, 1925-1960. So it's a great pleasure to welcome the professor, and really look forward to the easier of flip addressing and not really finding out what that is.
This paper follows on very directly actually from Caroline, so it's going to pick up on several of the same points. And basically, I'm going to be looking at those women who are marching around in North America wearing those copies of the Paris dresses. And I'm also taking the time frame slightly forward again. I'm looking at the period from about the end of the 1920s until the end of the 1940s. This is also moving the discussion into the context of print culture and specifically magazines, which I've been working on for a while. So I want to explore how the fashion reporting in the Canadian magazines that I'm working on relates to their nationalist agendas, and specifically how they take up notions of originality and imitation or reproduction through the construction of Canada as a middle space. So, this is just a really brief introduction to the project, so a couple of people have seen this one slide before. I'm working on this Strathclyde with my colleague Michelle Smith, and it's primarily an archival project. Only one of these magazines has been digitised, so we've been in the libraries. But it's also got a digital element, and this website, which does various fancy things, we've been creating in collaboration with the Canadian Writing Research Collaboratory, which is splendidly pronounced Quirk. So that's the website, and it will have kind of sample issues and timelines and things like that for these magazines. And today I'm going to talk about three of the six. First of all, Chatelaine, which is at the bottom in the middle. This is a women's magazine with quite a nationalist emphasis, which launched in 1928, and as you know, it's still published in Canada today. I bet you don't read it there,
Whenever I go home, I
buy one. It's a nostalgia magazine. I quite like it too. Mayfair, which is sadly dead, which was an expensively sort of fashion travel sport magazine, published from 1927 to 1959 in Toronto. And La Revue Populaire, which is this one, that was a Montreal magazine. It kind of started off as a pulp family magazine, but it went gradually up market, and that one lasted until 1963. Several of these came to grief in the early 60s. So I'm presenting French and English language titles alongside each other, both in the project and in this paper, but I don't want to collapse the differences between them. In some respects, they were very separate enterprises, and we haven't found a single example of any editor or author who contributed to magazines in both languages. The Anglophone magazines were almost entirely uninterested in Quebec, and the Montreal magazines, they did have a certain amount of coverage of English-speaking Canada, but primarily as a sort of possible holiday destinations. The one thing which united, I think, these English and French language magazines was the sort of shared anti-Americanism, because they were all influenced by US models in terms of design models and commercial models. But the actual text they published, there was a lot of resistance to Americanization, American influence. And another commonality, which is kind of an obvious one, is that both the English and French language magazines use Paris as a cultural reference point, and most especially in the area of fashion, so that's one kind of connection. And the project, as you can see, it goes on till 1960, but I don't want to go into the 1950s for this discussion, because things changed in Canada at that point, because a sort of Canadian couture industry started up in the 50s, whereas in the period that I'm going to talk about, pretty much all the fashion ideas came from elsewhere, from abroad. So the situation did change quite a lot at the beginning of the 50s. So in the wartime and interwar and Second World War wartime years, fashions which were current in Canada always came from elsewhere. So primarily from Paris at first, and later increasingly from New York. And so unsurprisingly, there were lots of discourses of fashion, travel and cosmopolitanism in the fashion columns, and a lot of the reports that were sent in from the Paris correspondent with much about the cultural events and parties they attended in the city as the actual clothes that they saw. So it was kind of about the whole trip that the correspondents went on. So that's how come we've got a bit about fashion in a project that's supposed to be about travel. So the magazines became at once exhibition spaces and marketplaces for imported foreign styles. This is just an example. I think it very much picks up on the fairy tale motif which we were just hearing about. And Mayfair magazine is here sort of presenting fashion as a dramatic, fantastic form, something theatrical to be admired from afar, you know, as kind of modelled by an international elite class. And so that's the front of the magazine. And then in the back pages, there were the shopping sections which presented these fashions as something that was available to every Canadian woman in the local shops. And there's one of these little advertorial texts in the box at the top of the page. They often had these. And this one reads, in one brief morning, you can shop the world around, buy treasures from the Orient, Paris, London, New York. And they are just around the corner from your own home. That is the charm and wonder of the Mayfair shops, the hats, the frocks, the bags, symphonies of chic, each bearing the magic name of some world-famous designer, and yet comparatively inexpensive. One cannot sail to Paris for every gown, but proud Paris comes to you through the shops of Mayfair. So some very rich Canadian women did sail to Paris to buy their clothes, especially in the earlier part of the period that I'm talking about, but not very many. And most of them would buy from local department stores, or in this case from small specialist shops. So obviously the shopping being constructed as a journey, and Mayfair then taking on the function of almost like a guidebook. And I like the way here that the world of fashion is something which is a space of fantasy, so you have charm, wonder and magic, but at the same time it's only just around the corner and it's quite cheap. It actually reminds me a little bit of the Narnia books, because it suggests this magic world can be reached just by walking into the wardrobe in your own house. And I've also, a lot of these reports have all these ellipses in as well, which seem to leave space for your imagination to supply the kind of images, and also perhaps suggest the impossibility of capturing the kind of je ne sais quoi French style in the English language. They're just full of ellipses. So even though there is a dependence on fashion inspirations from abroad, the Canadian writers place a lot of emphasis on creative response to them, and this is the way they conceive of Canadian taste specifically. It's all about how you respond to what comes in from the outside. This is the Paris letter in Chatelaine magazine in January 1931, and she, Ursula Burke, the author, describes various new couture models that she's seen, but then she gives a very practical account of the materials and techniques that you're going to need to be able to make them or copy them, and it's very detailed. And the strap line to the piece, which you can probably just about read, is making original frocks from Paris inspirations. The Chatelaine special correspondent abroad gives some valuable suggestions for interpreting the midwinter mode. This is the kind of discourse that they use. It was interpreting, not simply following the fashions, but kind of actively engaging with them. They're continually attributing a sort of creative agency to the reader of the magazine. But they did also insist very strongly, and even more strongly than I think American magazines do, on the difference between originality and eccentricity. So there's a really strong emphasis on not looking bizarre. I don't know if anyone's read this, but I've been reading a book by Miranda Gill about eccentricity in 19th century French culture, and she talks about the way it's kind of semantic associated with pathology and creativity at the same time. And there's a brief reference in her argument to the way that the forms of deviance can be normalised, which she says happens in the fashion industry, where things that are considered sort of outré one season are then sort of amalgamated into the mainstream. And I found this particularly useful because of the way that these magazines place such strong emphasis on avoiding the eccentric. And adapting parastyles so that they suit the Canadian environment, so they're not going to look too weird on the streets of Toronto. And this example comes from 1937, that's the cover of the issue. It comes in just so you can get a sense of the visualism of Chatelain at this period. Slightly lengthy quotation here, giving advice. Certainly you're not a fashion plate. You've got quirks and lines and a style personality. It gives you an opportunity to have a distinctive flair of your own, instead of looking like number six in a series of department store dummies. They don't carry off the first spring clothes you see that are obviously patterned after the dictates of the Paris designers. Think yourself into them first. And then it talks about these two pictures of these girls. Just above you'll see two very charming girls decked out in the dernier cri of spring millinery. The upper photograph is a clever example of adaptation. The model has a round face, so in choosing one of the new sailor beret hats, she doesn't go too pancakey or too tipsy as to line, or too extreme in any way. But alas, the girl below has made a mistaken flight into a pretty kettle of feathers. It's a new and smart hat, but meant for the petite, very perky type of jeune fille. So she's obviously a bit gamey for that. And obviously this type of hat demands a tight-fitting, flared shoulder line. I'm sure you knew that. So, I mean, there's a resistance, obviously, to mass production in the rejection of the store dummy series. And this appeals to the woman who wants an individual signature on her look, which I have been thinking, I won't go into this here, but I've been thinking about the way the sort of rhetoric of fashion writing relates to the rhetoric of modernism, which is kind of quite easy to pursue with something like that. But the woman's going to achieve this individuality not by eschewing the marketplace, as some modernist artists claim to do, but by operating cannily within it. So, shopping intelligently, and there's an emphasis on thinking about the fashions, engaging intellectually, not just adapting as in getting your needle out and adjusting the dress so it looks good on your shape, but also just kind of intellectually, you know, responding to these shapes and colours and designs. So there's a notion of originality as a process of adaptation, and this is often explicitly related to other dimensions of Canadian national culture. And so the example of this that I've got is from the editorial for the March 1928 issue of Mayfair, so it comes 1 year after the magazine was launched and looking back over the first year of production. And the editor, J. Herbert Hodgson, says, "What true Canadian has not dreamed of seeing his country recognised, taking its place in the world of arts of letters, establishing its individuality, individual literature, individual books, magazines? Who has not yearned to see virile young Canada expressing itself? To see sophisticated, cultured, yea, even distinguished Canada depicted to the life. And you, the fashionable elect of our country, women who are distinguished for your good style, you no doubt have dreamed of seeing the mode adapted to the interesting, the vivid personality of Canadian women. You saw the possibilities, the marvellous scope for a magazine which could do just this." So you have even more ellipses, again, I think suggesting a sort of vision of a possible future rather than something that's already been achieved. And there's some very grand aspirations here, but the tone remains quite cautious, as if to suggest that maybe it's going a bit far to describe Canada as distinguished or sophisticated. But there's a kind of real reticence about this, which disappears later, but at this point still seems to be evident. And quite a lot has been written about Canada's newfound cultural and political confidence after the First World War, which is important to note. But a lot of commentators in this period were still attacking a certain kind of colonial mindset. This is all a bit of a cliche, but a certain amount of caution and sort of continued reference to foreign models. And you can perhaps see that here, because the highest attainment that the editor can imagine is that the mode might be adapted in Canada, and there's no suggestion that fashion ideas could originate there, whereas, you know, in a very short time afterwards, that was exactly what they were suggesting. So it's still a kind of cautious moment. In the 1930s, advertisers placed a stronger emphasis on Canada's active role in the fashion industry, but it was still very much on the manufacturing or the dressmaking side of the process rather than the design side. So advertisements for Chatelain's mail order pattern service had titles such as "Translating the Paris Mode in Patterns of Canadian Make." So the manufacture is what's happening in Canada. And the implication is that if you buy these patterns from a local firm and then you make them at home, you're kind of contributing to your nation's creative and industrial development. And advertisers occasionally suggested that Canadian tastes and products might begin to influence the international fashion market. And again, that was something that was emphasised a lot more later on. But even here, and you can't read that Canadian Celanese advertisement, but it says, the latest thoughts of Paris expressed in fabrics by Canadian Celanese Limited. Fabrics so beautiful, so aware, so arresting, that even Paris is thrilled and inspired. So this starts to model a kind of slightly improbable two-way exchange of ideas. And I like the idea of the fabrics as being aware, as if they've got a kind of intelligence in themselves, that it says that. So the ideas come from Paris, but they encounter a sort of alert response from the other side of the Atlantic. That's the general idea behind a lot of these adverts. And one of the books I found really helpful, recommended by Caroline, is Alexandra Palmer's book Couture and Commerce, The Transatlantic Fashion Trade in the 1950s. And even though it focuses on the 50s, it looks back at the history of Canadian women as couture customers in slightly earlier periods. And she has a section on the vendors, the saleswomen who worked in the Paris houses, but also later who worked in the Toronto and Montreal department stores selling in special salons to her customers. And she says the prestige that was garnered by showing European couture was promoted in the fashion shows, and she has looked at a lot of the promotional brochures for those. And she talks about 1947 show Overture to Fashion, at which the commentator announced, "To own a model frock means to own a portion of someone's creative mind. It gives the woman a thrill to know that she can walk abroad and never meet herself. She will be recognised as the woman of taste and discrimination wherever she goes." Actually, I was telling this to Sean earlier. This reminds me of when I was giving a paper last year in Paris with Michelle, who works on the project with me, and it was about fashion. And then we both turned up, and we were both wearing this dress because we bought it from the White Company. So, it was very bad. So we just basically had to make it into a big joke. We'd done it on purpose because we were talking about, you know, imitation of fashion directors. So we looked second. So you can easily reach yourself, even at an academic conference. So anyway. Palmer goes on to say that an haute couture design purchased directly from the couture house was an insurance of exclusivity for the client's wardrobe, not because there wouldn't be any other versions of dress, but because the vendeurs would be familiar with the client's lifestyle and social circle, so she would have a lot of notes about the client and would make sure she didn't sell the same dress, if I've understood this right, to one of her friends. By the 1950s, a more serious issue was to safeguard a private client against buying a Ford, a design that would soon be knocked off in the mass-produced clothing market. And Caroline's obviously already been talking about some earlier stages of that process by which the models were mass-produced. But on the scale that it happened in the 50s, presumably would have been a lot more, a lot larger. But the evidence in the Canadian magazines is that this kind of thing was discussed using slightly different terminology from the 1930s onwards, rather than the 1950s. So this is the article that I got the title from, Is the Canadian Woman Better Dressed Than Her American Sister? We can maybe set up a debate on this. But anyway, quite fabulous. And this author, Gwen Barrington, quite indignantly outlines the process by which the most popular Paris models are kind of copied everywhere by US manufacturers. And she asked the reader to imagine herself visiting New York and admiring two passers-by who are wearing dresses that she recognises as being adapted from new Paris designs. So the reader's imagining herself arriving on Broadway, and immediately you'll notice another of those fetching little Agnes adaptations confronting you. Two more may pass through in quick succession. The copy of the Jenny Blair suit will be marching by on a thin girl wearing pince-nez, on a straw blonde of generous Swedish proportions, on a brace of brunettes from a Harlem nightclub, until it will seem that the street is swarming with women whose one idea is to conform to the same silhouette. These runners or flivvers, so called by the sorority of better shops, have reproduced themselves so widely that a select house would not touch anything resembling their original lines with a 10-foot pole, and yet the style idea will be repeated everywhere until it is an epidemic of checker caps. And I've found a few more articles in which there's this discourse of contamination that comes in the anti-American comments like that. And then just one other bit from this article. She argues that the Canadian woman possesses the gift of wearing clothes which depend for their appeal on some ineffable quality of individuality which defies the quick turnover of mass production. And this is really the thing I found the most interesting, that Canadian fashion sense in this period is often evoked in terms of a sense of distinctive choices among available options, rather than as an original style in itself. But it's also continually privileged over the supposed American habit of just copying what everybody else is wearing. And I'm not saying at all that we can ever measure any kind of historical truthiness, but that's the way they presented it over and over again, and that's the kind of conception they were trying to promote of what Canadian taste means. And so she says, Canadian women have unquestionably succeeded where their American sisters have failed in achieving individuality of choice. And these generalisations are obviously fairly ludicrous, but this is an isolated example. Because a single effect is good does not mean that it is better when it is repeated. And that's another interesting idea. Canadian women have learned to look beyond the mere statement of a fashion style and to analyse its possibilities for personal adjustments. Perhaps it is the sheer geographic necessity of blending American chic with English practicality which has produced this success, which, mingling with unconfessed worldly wisdom, has led them past the easy allure of sliver dressing to the very sound conclusion that, as there is only one of each of them, it is the subtlest sophistication to capitalise on the fact. So, obviously, the kind of legacy of colonialism inflects this fashion borrowing from America and written with somewhat politicised meaning. And Barrington, like several of the other fashion writers, evokes this idea of Canada as a middle space, able to combine the best of French, British and American culture and to sort of adapt these influences to a local environment. And they emphasise that you need to avoid extremes. And this idea of mingling the different influences is one good way of doing that, because you're sort of in the middle and you're avoiding the sort of outliers. So just as one slightly random example, there was an article on wartime fashion in Châtelet for April 1940, and it recommended canteen-shaped bags with red lining. And then the article added, a smart French woman was seen in the Ritz the other day with a black bag on which was inscribed, "It must stop once and for all," but we probably won't go that far in Canada. I don't know enough to say too very confidently about the changes that the Second World War brought on sort of in patterns of international exchange in the fashion industry, but obviously it had a huge effect. And in the early part of the war, Canadian magazines, in a sort of gesture of solidarity, celebrated French fashions even more enthusiastically. So Lotta Dempsey, the second quotation, says, "So long as the French couturier sets the fashions, women's clothes will echo the heartaches and triumphs of France." And she recommends sensible shoes because French women are having to wear them in order to work hard during the war. But when Paris, occupied Paris, became cut off from the North American fashion world, the tone changed a bit, and there was a bit more focus on the possible rapprochement between French and English-speaking Canada that could be achieved through the medium of couture. So there's a sort of hopeful piece by Kay Murphy, the New York reporter for Châtelet, talking about the French influence in Canada should contribute much towards carrying on the tradition of French couture in the Western Hemisphere. I haven't actually found a lot more evidence of that hope, or of whether it actually had much effect, but I'm still interested in finding, looking for some. The last piece there is another aspiration that the wartime situation might benefit the Canadian and North American fashion industry, as it certainly did. But in Canada, they hoped that the Dominion is going to stop following Paris and New York slavishly and formulate some of her own ideas for clothes. So some of these ideas, the first point at which you see them was during the Second World War, that now perhaps people should start designing their own fashions in Canada. But immediately the war was over, journalists resumed their attention to foreign fashions and to shopping with new enthusiasm. And I wanted to turn to La Revue Populaire now, which had this really interesting feature comparing American and French designs, and that's from July 1946. And these texts reveal quite a lot about post-war perceptions of French and American style more broadly, and the Canadian view of those two countries. So this is the one on New York. It's a bit too long, I couldn't fit an English version on, but I'm sure you can read it fine. So this focuses on the femme d'affaires, the businesswoman, who is going around on Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue in Broadway in her elegant yet practical outfits, which are well adapted to her active life. And it also says that the New York designers produce dresses which the factory worker and the society woman can equally well obtain. And there's a bit of scepticism here, I think, partly a bit of anxiety about the erasure of social differences as a result of these high society women and workers wearing the same clothes. And also, there's a reference to the occasionally eccentric and theatrical nature of the American designs as well. So it's quite a kind of mixed account. I mean, it does suggest that the American woman is, you know, is very active and she always looks tidy and neat and smart. But there's definitely some scepticism here, whereas the account of the Paris fashions on the other page is just completely celebratory. And the really interesting part here, I think, is at the end, it says that the American productions are produced very rapidly and in large quantities and only last for the length of one season. So the New York woman is always searching for something novel and different in order to achieve distinction. And then the way they contrast that with how we see Paris styles. These fashions are considered as seductive and fascinating rather than smart and practical, first of all. And instead of being produced quickly and in large numbers, there's a lot of emphasis, going back to things which Caroline and in fact several people in all the papers said, on the individual sort of craft people who are going to contribute the different elements of the designs. And they are represented in the terminology of art in terms of sculpture, sculptures, and sort of ingeniousness. And there's an idea of sort of inspiration here. I think the divergence between the New York and Paris modes of production as described in these pieces comes out not just through the text, which I'm actually going to just put side by side in a minute, but first of all, just look at the pictures again. The five New York images are all photographs, and the women there are either looking out at you or they're looking down at their own bodies, looking quite pleased with them. Whereas the Paris woman, there's one photograph, she's just kind of in the countryside, gazing off into the distance, and then you've got these sort of romantic sketches of women with their eyes shut. So you do have this sort of notion of this French woman kind of floating languidly back to the American ones, kind of, you know, ready for anything. I think that sort of direct challenging gaze on the left-hand side is quite a marked contrast with this floaty lady here. And you see a similar thing if you go back to the text. The New York text is a lot of short statements, and the sort of professional efficiency of the New York businesswoman is presented in these series of short, quite concrete statements, a lot of sentences and kind of lists of those specific details of what the clothes look like. Whereas the other passages, almost all of it is one long sentence starting up here. It just kind of piles up phrases. It's sort of evoking a kind of languorous elegance through this one very slow-moving sentence. So I just get an impression from this of the New York woman sort of marching along and the French one lying on a chaise lounge, and it's very different styles being used. And I think, again, there's a suggestion of French style is much more enduring and not tied to a specific moment in time, so the Paris woman doesn't need to keep buying a new dress every few weeks in order to keep up with the style. And that's obviously related to the contrast that's being drawn here between the mass production in New York and the sort of handcrafting, the whole mythology around that Caroline was talking about. And one thing which is kind of a little worrying about the left-hand passage is the right-hand passage, sorry, is the sort of eroticization of the labour of the seamstresses here, who are travaille amoureusement. La meilleure façon de ses rêves, tant cursé. Maybe the emphasis on their loving labours is perhaps, you know, a little bit worrying, but I mean, it's very consonant with French Canadian support for the Paris industry after the war. Another book I found very useful is Elizabeth Hooper's study of the marketing of authenticity in the early 20th century. And she has coined this phrase, the originary authentic. She's not talking about a specific aspect of early 20th century culture in the introduction, but she does have case studies of, in the book, things like the Bourneville chocolate factory, for example, where she talks about the sort of selling of nostalgia and authenticity through notions of community and sort of paternalistic organisation of labour. But she also says stuff about copies and originals, which I found very helpful. She says that the originary authentic equated authenticity with the original or the one of a kind, something that was not a copy. The mystique of the originary object had long been felt, but the turn of the century saw its rapid emergence as a powerful advertising strategy. It was defined by, and in part valued for, its alleged separation from the mass market, and it was likewise aggressively marketed in what are now familiar strategies, appeals to the coterie, to high fashion, to the limited edition. And part of the originary's allure was its evocation of the prototype, being the first, the cutting edge, and the new. And then she says the power of selling this laid its paradoxical promise middle-class consumers might allegedly have both the genuine article and something they could easily purchase, both the exclusive and the accessible, and the original and the perfect reproduction. And so even though she doesn't talk about magazines, that really reminds me of what's been happening in a lot of those articles I've been looking at, especially that Mayfair thing at the beginning with the Paris shops being just around the corner. And as I said, you know, couture originals were not directly available to most Canadian readers because they didn't tend to go to Paris to go shopping, and even when some garments were available for sale in Canada, it was still obviously much more frequently be wearing copies or similar garments. And the magazine's correspondents basically were offering advice on reproducing the styles via home dressmaking primarily in this period. So I think in disseminating news of the Paris fashions to a middle-class Canadian audience, the magazines were sort of participating in this kind of imposture, so upholding the whole mystique of Paris style by suggesting that it's unobtainable, but then in the back pages offering it for sale by copies, dress patterns and local shops in Kingston or Hamilton. And there's a clear implication that the designer's originality or will be sort of transferred to the woman who's got the imagination to make and wear these clothes. So again, attributing a lot of agency to the consumer. So I was going to talk about the notion of Canada as a middle space in relation to the middle brow, but I decided that what I was going to say was a bit rubbish, so I'm going to leave that. But I do want to make a sort of short connection with the middle brow. The reason that we understand these magazines as middle brow for the project is partly because of their emphasis on upward mobility, and practically all their contents are about how to improve yourself and raise your social position and cultivate yourself more. But also because they do seem to treat, they represent certain forms of high culture in their pages with that kind of ambivalence, which is, I think, fairly characteristic of the middle brow. So this notion of the ambivalent mediation of high culture within the field of popular culture, it's kind of relevant to the fashion coverage in the magazines because they do seem to subscribe to this notion of couture as high culture, if you like, as a sign of high culture, which was promoted in some French nationalist discourses. That's obviously somewhat problematic in one way and another. But also, I mean, going back to a book which I'm sure people read a long time ago, the Elizabeth Wilson Adorned in Dreams book, she talks about in the 20th century fashion continued to be obsessed with the new and different change in exclusivity but has been mass-produced, and how the mass production of fashionable styles links the politics of fashion to fashion as art and connects styles that circulate in high art and popular culture. And that's kind of useful for looking at these magazines because they do report, you know, often on the same page on the sort of the opera and the clothes and also the latest consumer products. And they do publish the romantic fiction, but then they'll also review a sort of book of serious poetry. So there's a real kind of mixing going on. And these are very, very generalist magazines because Canada had a small population. It couldn't support a huge range of specialist titles at this period. So, you know, where there might have been several magazines in the US catering to the same audience, it was all kind of blobbed in together in some of the, especially the French-Canadian ones. So they do become a sort of territory where high-end popular culture meets and where sort of art encounters consumerism. And that might sound like a fairly obvious point, but I just think it is perhaps slightly more striking in the context of Canadian magazines, which had to cater for this much broader audience and sort of reach out into rural, very rural and distant areas from their metropolitan centres. So dress, I think, in these periodicals isn't just a mode of middle class self-fashioning, it also does become an exotic journey, and on the other hand it can become a nationalist practice, as these women readers were encouraged to sort of embody Canada's creativity and help to develop it. So I'm basically taking up the magazine's own notion of Canada as a middle space which can combine and adapt American and European styles, but also which can sort of mediate high culture for a mass audience as well.